Hello, you're listening to FlixWise Canada, and today we're actually going to be talking about some Canadian films. I'm Martin Kessler, and joining me is producer, podcaster, James Hancock, who,
Hello.
If you don't know, you should. He's very graciously let me on Wrong Reel to talk about a wide range of film and film topics, and you've been a guest on FlixWise in the past, correct?
Indeed. I was on with Lady P discussing Stalker, and she came on Wrong Reel, and we discussed some Ernst Lubitsch, and we also discussed some Joseph von Sternberg. So, yeah, right. I believe that's... I can't remember if I did. Oh, no, I did a...
Were you on
a
Panther Panchali? Or?
Yeah, I did Panther Panchali as well, so...
So, you brought up the idea of discussing what's affectionately and sometimes not so affectionately called exploitation, which refers specifically to a sort of Canadian exploitation film that is mostly associated with tax breaks in the 70s, early 80s, which allowed Canadian film investors to receive 100% of their investment back in the form of a tax break. And that led to some very unusual films. I heard from David Cronenberg that, like, often they would be in situations where you would have a lot of money and very, very little time. So these films they'd often jump into with only a loose idea of where they were going. It would often write the script, the first draft of the script, well into production. So do you think that
how did the tax incentive work exactly? I my knowledge of taxes and accounting is pretty limited, but what exactly was like the structure to incentivize all these films getting made?
The way I understand it is if you wanted to invest in a film, whatever money you put into it, you would get back as a tax break. That money you could deduct from your taxes. So that's how you ended up with,
And if the film was a commercial success, though, how did that complicate things? Because I've heard of people dumping their money into movies as a write-off, but what happens if the film's successful?
I think you actually get profit, but I think most people were happy even if these films didn't make money. You know, so they didn't necessarily care if it was going into some bizarre horror film or whatever. But I think every once in a while these films did make money and... made money for their investors. And I think, like, sometimes you can see them trying to be more commercial in their own way. The way exploitation films often throw out very outrageous content to hook people in, I think that's part of it. But there's also, I noticed in a bunch of these films, they sort of try to pass themselves off as American films. I think probably to open themselves up to an American market. I noticed some of the films, they had Ohio license plates, or they were using American currency, or I think it's in The Pit when they have the sheriff, all of a sudden he shows up and it's an American police uniform. I sort of said, okay, it's supposed to be taking place in America. I forgot. I don't know. What did you think of that?
Well, I love any country that decides to indulge in making a lot of exploitation films. I mean, Ozploitation is phenomenal, and I love Hong Kong exploitation. I mean, any country that dabbles in it. I was at a film festival, not this past weekend, but the weekend before, where they showed that even the country of Uganda now is getting into the world of action exploitation films. And these are films that are shot on a very low budget, but I'm 100% in favor of it because of the one, take a sample size of 100 exploitation films from any country at any point in history, a few gems are going to emerge from the process, and I love me a good exploitation film, whether it's one that emphasizes sex, violence, sci-fi, like no matter what it chooses to exploit, I'm on board because eventually something fantastic is going to emerge. But quick question, just knowing so little about Canadian culture, what is a Canuck?
Good question. I don't know if I have a good answer. I think it's just meant to be sort of a broad term for a Canadian.
It's like calling like an American a Yank or something like that?
I think it's like calling an American a Yank. It's sort of like not exactly like polite proper, but I think like nobody's going to be insulted if you say it either.
Yeah, because I mean, my first exposure to the word was in the pages of the X-Men, people referring to Wolverine as a Canuck, and I was like, what the right. hell is a Canuck?
But that, you know, Captain Canuck, you had a superhero that was meant to be like a Canadian Captain America.
But what's cool also, yeah. I mean, like, we were looking at that website, which is all about, like, the history of Canuck-sploitation. It seems like there are a lot of people out there who not only admire Canuck-sploitation, but have made it almost a lifelong study, because it dates back to the 20s and 30s low-budget mm-hmm. exploitation films. Obviously, it's famous for the late 70s and early 80s films and the directors like David Cronenberg who came out of the process. But it seems like Canada's got a long, loving history of making low-budget genre films. And I feel like anybody who looks down upon that side of their film industry is missing out on a crucial, I guess, sliver of cinema.
For sure. I mean, when I learned about these films in film school, because one of the mandatory courses was Canadian cinema, there was a little bit of a derogatory attitude towards these films. Like, I think it was sort of framed that this tax break method of fostering Canadian cinema, Canadian cinematic culture, was ultimately something of an artistic failure. But I don't know. There's a lot in these films that I think is genuinely intriguing and artistic. And I think, you know, David Cronenberg's probably the most obvious example, but there were a lot of people that worked on these films that continue to
Ivan
have
Reitman
careers.
And Bob yeah. Clark. And yeah, there are a lot sure. of filmmakers.
There's people I've worked for. There's people I've worked with who started out on these films, actually, who have gained respectability, I guess, over the decades since. But I'm still a little bit curious, like, what sets these films apart? Like, the Ausploitation films, you know right away what you're watching. And even when they bring in American actors, like Road Games, you brought in Jamie Lee Curtis. They brought in Jamie Lee Curtis and
was it James Keach or Stacey Keach? Yeah, I always get Stacey the Keaches mixed yeah. up. Yeah.
So you have, like, two American leads, but, like, you're not fooling anyone that it's an American movie. They're, you know, it's got kangaroos, it's got dingoes, it's very much an Australian film. The Canadian ones, I think, like, because our countries are so close together and the cultures are so similar, you can sort of pass it off as American, but there's still things that it's a little bit more nebulous that I have a hard time pinning down that I think separate these films from American films.
Well, people talk about how there was the quote-unquote rural revenge years in the world of Canuck-sploitation. Sure. But I feel like I was just in Wisconsin for a film festival 2 weeks ago, and there are parts of America and Canada feel very similar in mm-hmm. terms of the accent and the sense of being geographically remote. And so I feel like it's not necessarily like it's not too much of a stretch to say that there's some common cultural heritage. But yeah, there is something really eerie and hard to put into words about a film like The Pit. But right. I feel like The Pit has, it's like someone described it as, I can't remember the exact words, but a weird mix of, like, after school special along with, like, weird, like, teenage adolescence horror. But it's a weird thing where you're not quite sure what the intentions were or mm-hmm. if they even knew what movie they were making at the time, because there's, like, stylistic inconsistencies. But I find this stuff fascinating, especially when you get into the sexual side of things, whether it's films like Shivers and Rabid, where you're exploring body horror and sci-fi, or films like Porky's, which are, like, I mean, it's one of the finest examples of the early 80s teenage sex comedies, a genre which sadly doesn't even seem to really exist anymore. But after Porky's success, it was...
I know, like, Porky's, for a long time, that was the most financially successful Canadian film. Period.
And Roger Wilson, who went to my boarding school, Woodbury Forest, is one of the stars of it. And he came and spoke to us about drama. And the frame of, basically, when he came to speak to us during our like 3 days of, like, drama studies, the fact that he'd been in Porky's gave him immediate credibility with every single student, because we'd all come of age where Porky's was a major event.
But how do you think, though, like, you have a system where very often it's government funding that sponsors these films, you know, so, like, people have objected to the idea of tax dollars basically going into making films like Porky's. What do you...
Or Shivers.
Especially when...
I know,
you know,
Shivers
came
heavily,
like,
under,
oh,
fire.
You know, we're going to be making, like, culture. We're going to expand Canadian culture in film. and then you end up with something that looks like Shivers or Porky's, do you think people were maybe right to be outraged that that shouldn't come from tax dollars, that should come from private funding only?
I guess my question would be, were there other films that aren't part of the exploitation scene that were also funded through this mechanism that were considered artistic, or I guess, like, you know, more respectable films, at least, like, or Academy kind of Oscar bait? Because for me, I do regard early Cronenberg as classic cinema. I understand at the time some people looked at it in a different light, but were there films that would be considered slightly more, I don't know, just more upscale or highbrow that also emerged from the same process?
Absolutely, although I think most of them aren't nearly as watchable. A lot of them, like,
I think Oscar bait doesn't age well. People always think, when people think of Oscar bait, they think at the time, like, they're so impressed. But movies that are trying too hard to be good for you inevitably age very poorly and become very topical and of their time.
I mean, there are sections of Canadian cinema that I think, like, they're very, there is a very potent culture, like Quebec, I think, because it's a distinct language and it's not like the same culture as France. It's its own thing. Like, you do get a lot of Quebecois films that are quite distinct. And then you have Native American cinema, Inuit cinema. Like, before on FlixWise, we did an episode on Antanasuat, the Fast Runner, which is a Canadian film about Inuit people set before the arrival of Europeans. And, like, it feels to me, even living in this country, completely, completely foreign. It's like a different culture entirely, different language, different everything. But like, when you're talking about Ontario English speaking Canadian cinema, often you're kind of dragged between, like, middling dramas and, again, these sort of weird exploitation films that seems to be where it falls into.
Yeah, well, I say empires are built on the back of exploitation films because they're cheap. Sure. And they're cheap and easy to make, and occasionally one of them breaks out and you get a film like Porky's, which on the surface people may frown upon, but here we are 36 years after its release and we're still talking about it. So clearly it does have some lasting cultural value, even if that value might be sneered at by more prudish members of society. But for me, I feel like a nice liberating sex comedy is healthy, because otherwise you just have a culture of sexual repression. You need movies like Porky's so people can have that release.
I mean, there is something, like, a little bit sexually devious in all of these Canadian films. I know there's a book called Weird Sex and Snowshoes that's sort of about Canadian film. But, like,
that's a great title.
There is something in Canadian culture that is sort of like a slightly kinked version of sexuality that comes up in a lot of these films. You know, Cronenberg, again, is the most famous, but, you know, The Pit has sort of a warped view of sexuality and many of these other films.
Oh, The Pit! There's so much going on in that. It is one of the strangest movies about teenage emerging sexuality that I've ever seen. And it actually, that movie made me the butt end of a lot of really, really brutal kind of humor when I was a kid. I'll never forget my name, you know, friends and family growing up, everybody called me Jamie. And of course, the main character's name is Jamie. And I walked into the living room one day, my older brother and a friend of his, Jonathan, were screaming and laughing, watching The Pit. And I must have been about 10 at the time. And they were freaking out. And they made fun of me for that movie for like 6 months. But this poor kid, like, you know, he's has no friends. All he wants to do is join people's clubs or ride bikes or play with them. And no, everybody just, like, hits him in the face and, like, roundly rejects him. He has an imaginary friend who may not necessarily be imaginary, because there is this one scene where the bear's head twists on its own, which I feel like almost the filmmakers didn't even bother to think through, because it never comes up again.
I'm sure they didn't. No.
Yeah, it's like they thought it'd be like a great, like, y'all didn't even, like, think about that scene before you shot it, because it totally puts the rest of the film in a completely different light, but they just thought it'd be cool.
Mean, there's also this whole element of these monsters, the trogs,
trollologs,
living in this pit. And I only watched it for the first time in preparation for this episode, and I thought, like, that there was going to be some kind of a twist where, oh, these trogs are just like a figment of his imagination, and so is the teddy bear, and it's him just acting out all this stuff. But no, they're real, and they get out. And it, like, it feels like a completely different kind of horror movie when it suddenly turns into a monster film.
It's two different movies that are sharing the same screen time. I guess
two wildly different movies. They're wildly different. But that's the kind of storytelling that came out of these situations, where, like, hey, we've got 2 months to put together a film from nothing to post-production. what's the story? Like,
but also, I love how the pit, like two-thirds of the way through it, just like, now we're a supernatural ghost movie.
Right.
Like, there's nothing has happened in the movie to date that would support the idea of ghosts coming back from the dead and speaking to us, but suddenly it starts happening. So it's like, this is a world where pet, like, stuffed animals are alive, ghosts can come back, monsters do exist, but it's like three different movies, and at the center of it is this weird, sexually repressed little boy who's super creepy. I mean, like, hanging out in her bathroom and writing, like, I love you on the wall.
What's creepy, like, there's, like, usually the creepy kid type horror movie, it's a lot of kids acting more adult than they actually are. This one, I almost felt like a lot of the creepy stuff was him acting like too young for his age.
Yeah,
like when she's standing like him, I'm like, he's 12, he can bathe himself. That's not right.
He wants to be an infant and a lover all at once. He likes to be bathed by girls, and he likes to have his teddy bear, and he's basically like a toddler who at the same time loves older women and like watches them shower or watches them sleep.
You know, a lot of the dialogue feels like it's written for somebody like a little bit younger, and just like, he's right at the age where his voice is starting to get deep, the actor.
Yeah.
So it, like, it just makes it really creepy, a lot of the acting out as if he was 8 or 9 years old instead of on the cusp of a teenager.
But with the bear speaking, I'm like, all right, the bear's voice sounds like his. That could be his voice in his head speaking on behalf of the bear. And so I can kind of get that. He's a crazy kid who has no friends, so he's projecting onto this bear.
Sure.
But in a scene where the kid's not there and the babysitter's in the room and she's like finding his porn stash under the mattress, the bear's head suddenly moves. I'm like, well, wait a second. Y'all are kind of contradicting everything else. This is actually now, like, that's yet another monster movie in addition to the other monsters that are at the bottom of this bizarre pit.
I mean, the storytelling, it's so all over the place. It actually, I think, helps the film feel creepy and unnerving because it's so unpredictable, and it like, you really don't feel like you can anticipate what's going to happen next, which I always think is kind of a good quality in certain horror films. Like, I love Lucio Fulci horror movies because they're so irrational. Like, I really don't feel safe while I'm watching it. And I thought there was a little bit of that in the pit where, like, I don't know what's happening. I don't know what's coming next. I don't know where this is going. I don't feel like I'm in safe hands. You know, like, usually you can sort of anticipate where a horror film is going, what it's
building
up to.
As a little kid, I have to say, though, like, nothing about it seemed weird. It seemed like straight horror. Granted, I was like a small child, but it actually really scared me. The part, spoiler alert, where Sandy falls in the pit and gets eaten really, like, upset me. And when she appears as a ghost and criticizes him for having dropped the rope in there, or when he lies about her boyfriend and she's like, oh, you shouldn't tell lies about people, it made my heart freeze in my chest.
Right.
So for it does that after school special angle does invite in small children because it feels like an innocent kids movie so much of the time until it's suddenly not one at all.
Right. Well, so many of these Canadian films, like, I didn't realize were Canadian as a kid when I saw them. It's just like later down the road when I found out, oh, that was made here, that was made in Canada. But like a lot of them, I remember renting from the video stores or seeing on television late at night. Like The Gate is one I saw on television, and that terrified me, especially I don't know if you ever used to do this, but like I remember watching it and it would get too scary and I'd flick channels.
Oh, I did it all the time.
Like when it was over. But I think what scared me a lot was the scene in The Gate when the parents come back home.
Yeah,
but they're not
you've
really
tweeted,
the parents.
You tweeted about this, yeah, a couple times.
Oh my god, it's so scary because like I feel like there's meant to be some kind of like parental, like when you're watching a horror film, especially about like kids, you feel like the parents are who they can go to, like that's where it should be safe, you know, like Poltergeist, there's no scene where the parents try and murder the kid, you know, so like something about that felt so transgressive. And The Gate, like it's a horror film, but it also sort of feels a bit like a kid's film because the main characters are kids, and like, you know, there's not like a huge difference between watching something like that and watching something like Monster Squad, which works quite well as a kid's film. But The Gate,
I watched them both right around the same age. Yeah, late 80s. I was like 11, 12 year old kid. But I used to watch The Gate during the day on HBO. And even though I started watching Nightmare on Elm Street movies and Friday the 13th movies. I'd started watching like some slasher movies of that time. And I felt like a pretty jaded experienced horror moviegoer at that point. But even watching The Gate during the day, I'm embarrassed to admit, parts of it actually really scared me. Like the part where the arms come out from underneath the bed and grab the legs.
Even before the arms come out, when it's just like the rippling on the walls, like that's yeah. a great effect.
I think it might have been easily 2 or 3, but perhaps even like 5 or 6 years where I would jump onto my bed as opposed to getting onto my bed because I kept thinking arms were going to come out and grab my ankles. Like, long past the point where I should have known better or should have gotten over that. For whatever reason, that image stuck in my mind. And if I was home alone, getting into bed like to go to sleep, I would always leap from like 5 feet away just on the off chance that those arms were going to come out and grab my ankles. So yeah, that is some astonishing power in spite of the fact that it is basically like a kid's movie with a little bit of like stop motion thrown in for good measure.
The special effects work, I feel like, is for what the film is quite good. There's this one great effects shot where the zombie tips over and it sort of breaks it apart into all these little demon creatures. And it's such a well-executed effect. Even today, I'm sort of trying to figure out like, okay, where's the line of separation between the actors in miniature and the, you know, is it stop motion? Trying to work out exactly what the effect is. And a lot of it's quite impressive.
But what I liked about that movie is that I saw it right at the time where all the weird older sister, like teenage bratty, like hookup right. kind of like temptation felt very true to life because everybody was talking about who's going with who or who's writing notes to who or who's gotten their first kiss or their first feeling up the shirt. And there's this one scene where they're doing the levitation and the boy leans over and puts his arm around the sister and kind of pulls her back onto the sofa. And I was like, that's a good move. I'm going to try that move and see if it works. It seems like it would be really, really effective. And so yeah, I saw this movie at the perfect time in my own adolescence.
One of the girls, not the sister, but like her friend who I think suggests that idea of the levitation. So she's like the one of the most famous Canadian indie filmmakers.
Nice.
Yes. Nice. she directed Modra, I'm a Good Person, I'm a Bad Person, The Animal Project. I think she produced Nurse Fighter Boys. So, like she's really, you know, somebody that like everybody knows now, but it's weird going back and watching and like, oh, that's like a tiny version of Ingrid Benninger.
Or a tiny version of Stephen Dorff. Stephen Dorff, this is his first movie. And this is going to sound horrible the way I say it, but there's something about him, his posture and his neck position and his haircut where every time I see him in this movie, I want to just like punch him in the face or like push him down. I don't know, there's something about it. He's like the most annoying little kid. And there's this one scene in particular where I feel that way where all this crazy stuff has been happening. They think it's all over, and they're like, let's all go to bed. And he's like, no, I want to watch some TV. And like the way he says it, I'm like, I'm going to punch you. Like, I wish he were my little brother just so I could beat him up because I don't know why he elicits those emotions from me.
Buzz off, clown face.
Yeah, I mean, in the 1980s, again, in pre-internet, the only thing you could base your opinion on whether or not to rent a movie was word of mouth. Or a great-looking box cover. Because, like, you were too young to care about blurbs or critical reviews. Like, right. It's something that, like, banned in 47 countries. That might make you more prone to rent it. But if it had a beautiful poster or box, then, yeah, you were all in. I remember I saw Neil Jordan's Company of Wolves solely because I thought the box cover looked killer.
Oh, like, this era, this was, like, the creme de la creme of VHS box covers. Like, the early 80s. So, like, some of these films, like, the early Cronenberg movies, like Rabbit, I didn't see until a little bit later, I think, when they were on DVD. But, like, I remember going to the video store, and they would have scanners. And you would see that cover with the Michael Ironside going all veiny and eyes
one of the,
white.
One of the all-time
like,
greats.
I need to see that. And, like, half the time, well, not even half. Like 90% of the time, 99% of the time, I feel like you would rent these movies hoping it was going to be what was on the cover. And like, it's usually a disappointment, but Scanners was not a disappointment. That one actually lived up to its box cover artwork.
Yeah. So, I mean, with Cronenberg, you really can't go wrong. I mean, a lot of people like to speak condescendingly about Shivers and Rabid as kind of freshman and sophomore efforts on his part.
But you know what? I like them.
I love them. I watched them again just a couple days ago, and they hold up so well.
They do. And like his style was already sort of intact, that kind of clinical approach, and like the themes are interesting. Like I'd much rather watch that than like the Dangerous Method. You know that?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think he's still obviously a fascinating, if you watch him in interviews, he's a fascinating guy. I think he got to, like, when around the time of Dead Ringers, realized he just needed to find some new material or some new subjects. Sure. Because if he had stayed in the world of body horror, I have a feeling he would have gone the way of, like, Dario or Argento, where you get diminishing returns. I like the fact that we live in a world where he made his Crash and that he made History of Violence. Do I like those movies as much as his, like, late 70s, early 80s stuff? No, but I like the fact that he continued to evolve and explore new frontiers.
Sure.
Shivers, though, I mean, it holds up really, really well. I mean, you got the wonderful Barbara Steele in there. You got the softcore porn actress, Lynn Lowry. But it has one scene, which I think is worthy of any scene in any Cronenberg film, where you have two doctors talking about the science of this parasite that they're developing. They're talking about, basically, instead of having an organ transplant, let's develop these parasites that can act as, like, you know, replace a bad kidney and filter the blood. And if they take a little blood, then you've got blood to spare. But it's very clinical and very academic in its approach, but it feels informed by actual real science. And it gives the movie an edge that so many horror films lack, because it takes it into the legit science world as opposed to just the world of make-believe. And there's something about, you know, a parasite designed to induce orgies that is so Cronenbergian. And it's incredible he made a movie this assured right out of the gate.
If you had, like, a supernatural explanation, like if it was a vampire that had a tooth in its armpit that turned people into zombies, that would be sort of ridiculous. Like, the fact that he finds a way to ground it, I think it goes a long way, and it shows the kind of thinking that he would use in when approaching films throughout his career.
Oh man, there's an interview with him where he talks about working on the film. He had a bit of a growing period initially on the first few days, because he said he got very easily distracted by all the various things going on the set, because there's just so much chaos on a film set. Mm-hmm. And he finally realized, like, you know what? I need to focus solely on what's inside the frame and let other people worry about everything else. Because if I don't worry about what's inside the frame, nothing else really matters. And that after a few days, he started to realize he actually might be really good at this. But some of his actresses were inexperienced. And I can't remember if it was Lynn Lowry or another actor, but there's one actress who said she was incapable of crying just by acting. And so she actually requested that he smack her in the face a few times in order to help get her upset where she could burst into tears. And when Barbara Steele saw him doing this, she basically grabbed him by his shirt and slammed him against the wall and was like, "What are you doing? I've worked with Louis Malle. I've worked with Fellini. I've worked with all the greats. I've never seen anything like this." And Cronenberg was like, "Look, she asked me to do it. She asked me to do it." And finally, Barbara Steele was like, "She asked you to do it? Well, can I try it?" And he was like, no. Because the other one was starting to, like, show bruises on her face. It was a total mess. But at any rate, he learned very, very quickly. And yeah, I think Shivers is one of the crown jewels in the Cronexploitation movement.
Absolutely. Yeah, Rabid, Shivers. I know those films, like, they're so easy to just put on and get immersed in that world. And, like, it's sort of, I mean, for me, like, they're before my time, obviously. So, like, seeing images of these Canadian cities I've been to and know quite well just in that era, like, it feels so different and interesting, just, like, inherently interesting to see these familiar places looking as they did in the 70s. Yeah, like,
do you think some of the condescension from Canada comes from the fact that actresses who worked in the adult entertainment industry were working in these movies? Because Lynn Lowry did a lot of softcore porn. And then in Rabid, you got Marilyn Chambers, who was a legit, like, XXX star of the 1970s. I mean, she was, like,
Behind the Green Door, that was huge.
I mean, she's a massive, massive porn star. And that was her attempt to kind of go legitimate when she did Rabid. So that might have also played into some of the pushback that some people indulged in.
Yeah, I think there was, like, just a general error that, like, these films are not respectable. They're, like, I mean, horror in the eyes of, I think, like, a lot of film critics has always been sort of just, like, one step above pornography in terms of respectability. And, like, especially low-budget horror, I think that just comes with the territory.
I kind of wish, though, Rabid were still available in the low-budget, like, kind of grainy, poor transfer, where I first saw it on VHS, where the image was barely discernible because the tape was so degraded. And I watched it on YouTube a couple weeks ago, and, you know, it's all pristine and perfectly restored. Right. I'm like, oh, man, like, it's too clean now. Like, there's something about a really grainy tape that might break any second that lent Rabid a certain quality, a texture that is missing when it's perfectly, like, same thing with Evil Dead. I grew up watching watching Evil mm-hmm. Dead on the crummiest VHS as imaginable. They've been watching it a billion times. And the movie somehow works a little better when the sound warbles in and out and that sort of thing. When you watch it perfectly
restored.
It's like restored,
a little bit dark. You can't yeah, quite see what's in the shadows.
Some of the magic is lost when it's too clean.
I'm not somebody who's like usually like, oh, super nostalgic about VHS tapes. But like it is so different sometimes when you've seen these films on VHS for so many years and so often. And then you go and see like the brand new HD transfer restoration. And it's like it's not the same movie anymore. It nope. looks so different. And like in my head, the VHS quality, like some of these films I thought must have been shot on like video for VHS, and like no, they're shot on 35 millimeter film and they're gorgeous. And I don't know, it changes the experience. Some of these films were never meant to be seen in theaters, you know, the direct-to-video stuff that came a little bit later. There's so many examples, but like, you know, you're literally watching it in a better quality than it was ever intended.
Than they probably so, even saw in the yeah. editing room. Like, at the time they cut it.
Yeah, you cut it on, like, a little moviola or something. Like, it doesn't look as good as me putting a Blu-ray on my
Well, it TV. Makes some of the horror effects seem more believable. Like, a movie like Cannibal Holocaust, you don't want right. to watch a clean version of Cannibal Holocaust. You want a grainy, beat-up version because it makes it feel more real and more documentary. I feel like that whole late 70s, early 80s, low-budget grindhouse horror era coincided with the arrival of VHS. So for me, they're totally inseparable from one another. And sadly, young cinephiles will never get to experience those movies on VHS as they were supposed to be seen.
Right. It's the same with the television stuff where I know like the Star Trek TV show, all the effects were done at like a certain quality. So when you're doing like the fancy HD versions, they're like, what do we do? Do we recreate them from scratch with CG? Like it just won't hold up on that scale.
Yeah, it's a weird thing. Like with those old Star Treks, I actually don't like watching. Cause I made this argument, we did an episode about them. But if you say like in 2012 or 13, whenever they did the new version of the special effects, right. those new versions of the special effects are going to seem outdated in a matter of years anyway. So what are you going to do? Like update the special effects every 5 years? So it's just leave the original crappy special effects in there. Like right. You don't need to do like a special edition of Forbidden Planet. Like just let the special effects be what they are. It's of its time. And yeah, I right. really dislike it when people go in there and start changing the original footage. But quick question about Rabbit. I need a little help with what actually happens in it. Essentially, she gets burned and hurt in the motorcycle wreck, right. and they're doing like an experimental skin grafting process, which right. results in this sphincter-like vampire needle that comes out of her armpit.
Right, but this little tooth comes
tell
out of her
me,
armpit.
Tell
yeah.
me, I couldn't make sense of it. In terms of the logic of the movie, that A, leads to her to develop that mutation, and why that mutation turns people into zombies.
Good question. I mean, like, I assume experimental science is the key word there, and it's like, oh, these cells grew in some unexpected way and created this contagious, venomous tooth. I don't know. I wish I had a good answer for it, but I think it's just, again, one of those things where it's irrational, but it's scary, so it kind of gets away with it. And even the way, like, it's a little bit like a vampire film or a zombie film. It sort of reminded me of...
reminds me of Life Force. It reminds me of the Toby Hooper Life Force. Where, like, you know, you have these yeah. weird zombies emerging as, like, a byproduct of the space vampire.
Right. But Rabbit does a good job of making it feel like what you're watching, it's totally apocalyptic, when really you only see, like, a handful of people become zombie vampire things. You know, but, like, you feel like, the whole world's in danger, you know, despite the relatively small scale of the film.
Yeah, I mean, you feel like you're on the verge of a pandemic that's going to do all sorts of horrible things. And yeah, I think Rabbit holds up well. And then, of course, I mean, The Brood, I don't even know if that technically is part of like the tax shelter years anymore.
I think
like
so, that is, yeah.
And because yeah. it stands on its own. So, I mean, obviously, I feel like The Brood, for me, is Cronenberg's first real masterpiece. And so it kind of transcends Canucksploitation. Yeah.
I mean, you can see, like, little personal things throughout his other films and, like, all his little interests, you know, with biology or even, like, the mechanical. Like, the fact that Rabbit starts off with a motorcycle crash. It
yeah, he's a big car buff.
Crash, you know. I know, like, he's super into motorcycles. He have motorcycles in Eastern Promises. And, like, the design of the pods and the fly were based on a piece of a motorcycle. Like, you know, he has that mechanical interest. But I think, like, The Brood, it was sort of him dealing with the divorce of his wife, which
oh,
like,
big
was
time.
Not on good terms. And like, I think he said like that's his Kramer versus Kramer.
Yeah, but, no, whatever yeah. divorce he was going through, if that, I mean, AO is worth it because he it resulted in a great movie, but I pity the poor man for having, if what he experienced in real life is even 1/1000th of an approximation of what is seen in that movie. I mean, he must have endured something very rare and special on a personal level.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, you can definitely tell, though, that there's like something
intensely
more personal.
Yeah. Yeah, without a doubt. Yeah, I mean, it's him exercising the demons after 1 or 2 years of just absolute horrible personal trauma. I guess, but one thing we shouldn't overlook about this period is the role that Ivan Reitman played in producing some of this early Cronenberg work. Because Ivan Reitman's obviously one of the most successful Canadians to emerge from this Canuxploitation era. Because while he started out directing Canuxploitation, he very quickly graduated to doing things like Ghostbusters in a short period of years. So this is when I'm like taxpayers in Canada complain about the trashy movies that were the result of Canuxploitation. I'm like, yeah, but you also produced Ivan Reitman, who made one of the biggest blockbuster comedies in the history of the movie industry. So clearly it bore fruit in a variety of ways.
Famous Slovak Canadian.
Oh, interesting. I did not know that. You're Czech yeah. Canadian, so, he's so Slovak
is,
Canadian?
Yeah. So is Ingrid Veniger. She's Slovak.
It's also cool that just Canada chose to place an emphasis on it, that they've said, look, this is something that is of value. We need a homegrown film industry. And I love the fact that, like, you know, you look at someone like today, like Guy Madden, who I regard as one of the most interesting filmmakers in the world and one of the most entertaining. Without the Canadian film industry essentially providing him grants from time to time, his career would not have been possible. And so there is something to be said for quote-unquote socialized filmmaking in a lot of ways. However, David Cronenberg, in a pretty chilling interview once, there's this great roundtable discussion he had with John Carpenter and John Landis in the early 80s, and they're talking about the notion of censorship. And David Cronenberg was laughing, saying that, yeah, most Americans talk about censorship, but they don't realize that what censorship even means. Because in America, you make a film for a studio and you submit your cut, and maybe they'll use your cut, maybe they won't, maybe they'll recut it, maybe they'll fire you, who knows? But at least you got to make your movie. In Canada, their version of censorship is you turn over the movie to the Canadian government, and then they edit it according to their own desires, and then they give it back to you. Like, he's like, that's legitimate censorship. It's just a very different thing. So that's something you have to accept when you're dealing with you know, a system of filmmaking that's involved with the government.
Sure, and there's been huge controversy.
I mean, they have a point. If your tax dollars are going toward it, at that point, everything's debatable. Like, whether you're debating a road to be constructed or the size of government or healthcare or military, like any of these things, if you're voting for politicians who are coming up with these plans, you essentially are all involved. So, you know, while people might complain about making movies by committee in the movie industry in Hollywood, at least it's just a private company. But if you're making a movie with tax dollars, you're essentially making a movie by committee with your entire country. And so people definitely, I mean, for me as an American, as an outsider looking in, I love the fact that Canada did all this. However, if someone were to say today, hey, by the way, President Trump is going to start doing, you know, tax shelter, government-funded movies, I'm like, well, that sounds like a very strange idea. Like, do we really need to be spending our money on this? So I totally understand people's concerns. I guess I have the benefit of hindsight being 2020, looking back and saying, oh, well, Canuxploitation led to horror movies like Prom Night or sex comedies like Porky's, so 100% it was worth it. But I'm looking back with 30 years of, you know, perspective.
Right. Sure. I mean, like, again, even outside of just, like, the respectability, there's, like, films that get funded with Canadian government money that people sort of argue they shouldn't be because, like, they're not recognizably Canadian. Like, that's sort of a big issue that comes up a lot. Like, do you know Deepa Mehta?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, like, she's a Canadian citizen. She makes films with Canadian money. Nobody realizes that they're Canadian because
I always assume they're Middle Eastern or Indian or something like that.
Yeah.
She did, like, Earth, Fire, and Water and all those movies.
Yeah, those are Canadian films, technically.
Yeah, I would have assumed they were, made in Asia.
So people sort of argue, like, why are we funding these films with the idea of, like, okay, we're going to increase, like, the Canadian film culture if, like, they're not recognizably Canadian, if they look Indian, or if, you know, these films are putting up American flags to try and sell tickets in America, you know, like,
well, which films do embody Canadian virtues and Canadian values and kind of Canadian archetypes?
Like, an ongoing issue because, like, Canadian content in film and television, like, I don't know if you know SCTV, we're a lot of, like,
I don't.
like a lot of the people who ended up going on to Saturday Night Live and Ghostbusters started on this Canadian show, SCTV. Okay. And that's where the Rick Moranis, Dave Thomas. Do you know the Bob and Doug McKenzie?
Those names sound so familiar. Is that, were we talking about like the whole like kind of like Strange Brew kind of film culture?
Yeah, that's the Strange Brew guys.
Gotcha.
So like initially they were on this show, SCTV. That's where they started from. It was sort of like a Canadian version of Saturday Night Live that wasn't live. It was like a sketch show. And like, you know, there was pressure. Oh, you have to put in this much Canadian content. So they said like, well, what even is Canadian content? And they had this skit, which was a joke, you know, where they're wearing toques and talking about Canadian bacon and, oh, you hoser. It was like a complete joke of the idea of Canadian culture. And eventually that became the most popular segment and got spun off and turned into a film, Strange Brew. So like, you know. It's not like a easily quantifiable thing what constitutes Canadian culture.
When I think of Canada, I mostly think of like hockey. I think of like MMA. I think of like the athletics. There's something about those brutal winters you guys experience that yields these extraordinary athletes who are just like these larger than life figures. I think of a George St. Pierre with this speaking with his adorable accent and that sort of thing. So yeah, I just think of mountains and snow and warriors carrying like weapons or fighting with their hands and feet. Like for me, that's Canada. And I know also people leave their doors unlocked and don't worry about anything. So it's a really, really, it's so different from America in some ways.
I lock my doors, but outside of these cut exploitation films, like what do you think of as Canadian cinema?
For me it's Guy Madden and David Cronenberg all the way. I mean, there are obviously exceptions like Adam McGoyne and sure. Like, you know, a movie like Sweet Hereafter, which I think is a remarkable movie in so many ways. So there are great, but and I think of course like there are a lot of famous Canadian movie stars who have come down to America
and escaped.
Yeah, they've escaped. But I always think of it as I always regard film director first. So yeah, in terms of contemporary film, Guy Madden, and in terms of 70s and 80s, David Cronenberg, they're two of my favorite filmmakers who ever lived. So those are the first two filmmakers that come to mind always.
There's still like genre films that are made today, like that are kind of not necessarily what could be called exploitation, but are kind of in that tradition. You have something like Cube, it's still a genre film.
What about Scott Pilgrim versus the World, which is set in Toronto, but not made by Canadians?
I think, like, again, like, there's Canadian crew on that. There's it's pretty common where you see, like, Toronto dressed up as other cities that, you know, like, did you see the documentary Los Angeles Plays Itself?
I have not, no.
It's like it's almost like a Room 237 style documentary where it's all this footage of various films showing like all the famous locations in Los Angeles, and it's kind of a history of LA through film. But like if there was a Canadian version, it would be Vancouver never plays itself or Toronto never plays itself. So I think one of the pleasures of Scott Pilgrim versus the World was just seeing Toronto as Toronto. And being like, oh, there's Sonic Boom. There's, yeah,
we have a similar thing where I'm from. Like in Richmond, Virginia, it's always doubling for DC just because there's the unions in Virginia are slightly less expensive or time consuming to deal with than the unions in Washington, DC. So people say, screw it, let's go to Richmond and we'll just dress it up to double for DC, unless we're at, you know, Union Station or the Pentagon or something that can't be doubled. But yeah, Richmond does that quite a bit.
Because you always have like American productions coming in and like they have to bring in a certain number of Canadian people, but like they're not really Canadian films. So you have like Suicide Squad shot in Canada.
Interesting.
You know, like sections of it anyway, shot in Toronto, and like you can't tell.
Well, what about Porky's, which is kind of a Canadian movie, but it's set like in the American South. This shoot in Canada, or is it an American, or is it a Canadian film?
If I remember correctly, I think it's like half in Canada, half in Florida.
Yeah, because it's like a total hillbilly kind of like redneck
American
movie, but it's also Canadian film, and you know, you got all these like American movies. Is Kim Cattrall Canadian or is she American?
Good question. I will Google that.
Yeah, I mean Kim Cattrall.
Yeah, Kim Cattrall is Canadian.
Very nice. Very cool.
Yeah, but I guess Porky's. That's.
That's the film that made her. I know she obviously was the overtly sexual character in Sex and the City, but in Porky's, it's something else entirely.
The same director who did Porky's, Bob Clark, he also did Black Christmas. It sort of depends who you ask, because like I think everyone kind of picks a different point, but a lot of people do refer to it as the first slasher film.
I'd say the first slasher film made in the Western Hemisphere.
Okay.
Because for me, Bay of Blood is like, for me, the real first slasher movie, the Mario Bava flick, just because so many of its scenes were ripped by Friday the 13th Part 2, like identical shot-for-shot rips. And if Friday the 13th is a slasher movie, then Bay of Blood certainly is as well, even if only like a third of it feels like a slasher movie. But obviously that's an Italian filmmaker, Mario Bava. So, but I feel like Black Christmas really is the beginning of it in the Western Hemisphere.
Okay, that's a good distinction. Because I guess you had like a lot of these giallo films. Gialli?
I guess Gialli is the plural, yeah.
Okay, I got... you know, and they were sort of ripping off Psycho, which was like, and also sort of a slasher, proto-slasher film. So it's kind of weird, like you go from...
I think of Psycho as the last classic Hollywood horror film. It's kind of like the last one that looks and feels like an old school Hollywood movie in terms of the photography, the Bernard Herrmann score. It's classy. Right. Granted, it's got violent murder, but it, for me, it's from the same tradition as like Henry Georges Clouzot's like Diabolique and movies like that. Like
yeah.
It doesn't, for me, I don't lump it in with the slasher films to come. No. I feel like it's the last film of that
era. I
mean,
era. I like Black Christmas, but it doesn't exactly scream classy.
No, it doesn't. But, no. You know, but it's, I don't need my movies to be classy.
Right. No, it's good, actually. Like, it's, you know, still scary. And it's still, like, you know how, like, there's such a big difference between, like, early slashers and late slasher films?
Well, the late slasher films just weren't even scary at all, whereas early slasher films at least were trying to scare you, whereas they became kind of fun. I remember going to see Nightmare on Elm Street 3 as a kid in the theater, and when Freddy slid into frame, everybody went, yeah, and like fist pumped. Like you were yeah. rooting for the bad guy, whereas early slasher films, you were not.
Also, like in the early slasher films, I feel like they always played up like the mystery of like who's the killer.
And 100%, like in
80s,
Prom Night.
That was gone. Yeah, like Prom Night, that was a big, big part of the plot is like, oh, is it?
I thought it was Leslie Nielsen.
The guy plays the. Right. Well, I think the first time I saw it, I thought the twist was going to be that it was Jamie Lee Curtis who like felt guilty and was punishing them. And I was like, oh, wouldn't that be good if it was? No, but no, that's not it. I like that it's also a horror film which has like a 15-minute dance sequence.
It's like really, so it's like a Staying Alive kind of Saturday yeah. Night Fever dance sequence. Also, like 2/3 of that movie is not even a horror movie because none of the killings really start until like the last 20 or 30 minutes of the movie. The rest of it's just a high school drama.
I mean, it's still pretty gruesome, but I feel like compared to what slasher films would become by the end of the 80s decade, like it feels so kind of tame, actually. Slasher films, it used to be like a big deal, like, oh, he killed that person with a knife, now he's got a pitchfork. And like by the end, especially when you like watch you know, the big Nightmare on Elm Street type films, Friday the 13th, the kills became so ostentatious, like that just didn't cut it anymore. Like,
well, especially with like the 90s like slasher film throwbacks where the movies were all about just coming up with imaginative gags, whether it's like
yeah.
the latter Halloween films or the I Know What You Did Last Summer or Scream or whatever. There was like a brief period which I think is one of the weakest periods of the slasher film, where it became all about these interchangeable good looking 20 something casts that all dress the same, look the same, act the same, who die to these increasingly elaborate scenarios. And I just felt they were so weak and so unsexy and so not scary. And I just feel like, yeah, that late 90s slasher period. I mean, you were tweeting about this the other day, or maybe it was Dave Ease, but just talking about how weak American horror was in the late 90s, early 2000s. And it was sure. at that time where Japanese horror was really coming into its own, which is why you get so many American remakes of Japanese horror films mm-hmm. in the early 2000s.
I think what kind of killed off horror films was that you had Silence of the Lambs come out, and that was a big hit, and that was very respectable and got awards. And
won Oscars up the wazoo.
Right. So I think like all of a sudden funding that would have normally gone into horror films instead went into these kind of thrillers that brushed up against horror. So you had stuff like Seven, you had stuff like Bone Collector, and that kind of culminated, like that fad only really died out, you know, like I think around the same time as The Cell. That was sort of like Matrix meets Silence of the Lambs, you know.
Yep.
Like so I think like that kind of encompassed 90s and sort of overshadowed 90s horror film.
You yeah, a lot of movies starring made, Angelina like, Jolie and Ashley yeah. Judd, and they're like police procedurals with a little bit of a serial killer kind of slasher edge to them.
Right. So like I think that's kind of what killed American slasher films for a period. I don't know, you had Scream, which kind of deconstructed them and also sort of revived them, but it felt like by the time it was revived, it was already dead again. So
it wasn't revived really until... it But I feel like Scream, kind of by the end of even the first movie, put it back in its grave. I mean, by the very end, it's not scary at all anymore. It's almost making fun of itself by the end. And so I feel like Scream should have been a one-off. And instead, we got 50 million cheesy rip-offs and spin-offs and cheap imitations.
Right, because you still had, like, I Know What You Did Last Summer. You had all those films that kind of came, what else was there? Urban Legends.
Yeah, Halloween.
There's like a bunch of those. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, there's just so much about that period.
Well, one thing I always thought was like a little bit strange about the difference between America and Canada is our rating systems are different.
Well, so, how does it work up there?
Well, like we still have like rated R, but like we also have 14A, we have 18A.
What are the A's stand for?
Adult accompaniment. Okay, so there's G, which is general audience, PG, which is parental guidance, 14A, which is which I think means you have to be accompanied by an adult until you're 14.
So that's our PG-13.
Yeah, then you have 18A, which is adult accompaniment until you're 18.
And that's our R, which is 17.
Then you have R, which means you're not allowed to see it at all until they're 18, even with an adult.
So that's our NC-17, yeah. But what's the difference between y'all's NC-17 and R then? Because like for us, R, you can be 5 and see an R movie. Like I saw Conan with my dad because it was my dad. But NC-17, which I can't even remember the last time a movie got even released in America with the NC-17 rating.
That's sort of,
it's
kind of
fallen away.
Like Showgirls was probably the biggest film to ever be released as NC-17, right?
Yeah, it's kind of like with the death of the video store, NC-17 became almost irrelevant because back then Blockbuster refused to carry NC-17 films on their racks. They wouldn't have any. And so it was a big deal in the late 80s, early 90s when a film like a Philip Kaufman film like Henry and June was NC-17. Right. Like, oh, this is like a sophisticated art film with a lot of open, frank sexuality. That's what NC-17 is for. But I can't remember the last time that label's even used. It seems like, and thankfully, the MPAA is becoming increasingly irrelevant, except for big popcorn tentpole releases.
I mean, earlier we were talking about the sort of strange sex of some of these Canadian films, but they're fairly open, I think, compared to a lot of comparable American films. Like,
is it safe to say that Canada has a little bit more of a European attitude towards nudity and sexuality compared to, I mean, at least in terms of like,
well, I don't know about that, but like, I think like people probably are a little bit more open to the idea of sexuality or like, you know, hey, we're adults.
Like, do y'all have any Puritans, like descendants of Puritans in Canada? Because obviously we have the descendants of like the Northeast where we had like the Puritans landed and then they spawned several generations. And I feel like their influence of puritanical morals is still felt to this day in a lot of ways. And I feel like maybe I would at least hope that Canada doesn't have that influence, but I just don't know enough about Canadian culture to know.
I mean, like, you probably could find it, but, like, it doesn't feel as puritanical, no. Like, sometimes the stuff I hear about, like, oh, this had to be censored out because of the sexuality sounds so ridiculous. But, again, like, we're so close to American culture that I think a lot rubs off. You know, that, like, I was watching a clip on television talking about Ghost in the Shell, the original animated version.
Which I love.
They were showing a clip of, you know, when she's on top of the tank and she's pulling and like her arms rip off?
Yeah, her muscles are like, at first it looks like her muscles are bulging, but then they start to rip and pop and tear. Yeah, it's an incredible scene.
You know, so I was watching a clip of that on TV as they were talking about it and they like blurred out her nipples.
Oh,
but like you're
God.
Also watching somebody's arms get ripped off. Like it felt like such a weird contradiction. That, like,
also, they're not even nipples. It's robotic flesh. Like you could say, oh, it's basically it's synthetic matter made to look like a human. So it's, you're not even looking at boobies.
I kind of don't like the new live action version with Scarlett Johansson. They just turned it into like a flesh colored suit. But I'm like, that's not right.
Well, it's a PG-13 mainstream movie from the guy who made Snow White and the Huntsman. So
I know.
Man, there's a lot wrong in the conception of the film. I don't mind remakes or reimaginings as long as it's not a watered-down PG-13, family-friendly, accessible version.
But like David Cronenberg kind of set the bar for what a remake could be, which is The Fly. Like
it's the best. It might be the best remake ever.
It might be. It's and like it's.
But he waited 30 years, and he made it way more hardcore than the original. Well, now that David Cronenberg is like, you know, always like on the jury at Cannes and he's made all these important films and he's, you know, regarded as one of the best directors of the last few decades, do people in Canada still have an ambivalent attitude toward the Canucksploitation experiment that yielded a filmmaker like him. Because for me, he's just a remarkable director, unlike any of the last 40 years. And without this Canucksploitation tax shelter period, perhaps he might have just stayed in med school and just been a doctor.
I think that's very possible, but people do still disparage these films.
Like, is heavy metal part of this whole phenomenon, or is that unaffiliated with the tax shelter era? Because I know obviously it's a Canadian film from the early 80s, but it seems like by 1980, it seems like abuses of the system and corruption kind of brought it to a close, because people would only end up using 10% of the money actually for the shoot, and they were pocketing the rest.
Yeah, that happened a lot too. And, there was like a lot of that going on, people pocketing money. It was sometimes hard to trace the finances of these films. I think Heavy Metal wasn't technically like a tax shelter film. I think that was like just a production with independent money, but it's a Canadian film. Have you seen the sequel, Heavy Metal 2000?
I never have, because no one's ever told me to watch it, and I kind of my love of heavy metal is so intense that I don't want it to be tainted, unless someone says, look, it's worth your while. But I've never heard someone say that.
I will say it's worth your while. I love that movie, actually.
Interesting. All right. You're the first.
I'm surprised. It's got like, again, it's sort of a Canadian production. You have Michael Ironside doing a voice. It's all based on like one story instead of a bunch of different stories. I don't know if you know Heavy Metal Magazine, the Factum.
I don't know if I've read those stories or not. Who's the writer or the artist who created Factum?
I don't know. I forget the writer and the artist, but it's like specifically from one of the stories that was serialized in Heavy Metal.
Gotcha.
So it's like all one plot. It's this kind of space opera-y stuff. I think like part of why it's not liked even right now is it was kind of that era when they started mixing CGI in with a lot of the traditional animation, and like they don't always gel well.
Yeah, even like Ghost in the Shell did a bit of that.
Oh, the sequel. Have you seen the second Ghost in the Shell?
I've not, no.
Okay, they really do that. Like, there's scenes where they, like, do whole characters and airplanes and stuff, like, as CGI, and it just doesn't fit into that world at all.
They kind of vomit each other out. Like, they don't always match, and so... But I can totally understand that impulse, because, like, on a big-budget level, movies like Beauty and the Beast, the animated film, did have, like, a CGI ballroom, and they're dancing inside, and so you could see some of those experiments working in that context, but if the budgets weren't as grand, then it kind of... failed.
Yeah.
It's weird. Japanese CGI has never really taken off. I can't think of any big, beloved Japanese CGI animated films.
Do you think that's because the Final Fantasy movie flopped? Because it sort of seemed like that was supposed to be the groundbreaking, like, okay, like, this is going to open up a whole new world of, like, CGI animated movies, and that
maybe they
flopped,
just,
and they kind of retreated from that.
They probably just are all very content to do cutscenes and cinematics for video games. But it is weird. Like, we've had 22 years since Toy Story, and there hasn't been one major, like, Akira-type film from Japan that's CGI. That it's still 2D traditional cell animation.
That's actually surprising, because CGI, it's sort of cropped up everywhere else as kind of the predominant form of animation, but...
I love the fact that someone's keeping 2D alive, but you would think in 20 years that, like, somebody would be like, screw it, we're going to do it, we're going to do it right, but...
I mean, Canada actually has like a pretty good history of animation, especially during that tax shelter era, because like it was cheaper to produce there. So you did have stuff like Heavy Metal. One of my favorites, it's Rock and Rule. I don't know if you've ever seen that.
I have not, but I always hear about it. And it's one of the things where I'm always hell bent upon hunting it down. But I think it's available like in an illegal version just on YouTube.
That could be. I mean, I have it on DVD. They released like a special edition, and then I think that maybe went out of print, because like I've seen it on sale for ridiculous amounts of money now. But that was like another one I would watch late at night and flick away when it got too scary. And then like the next day, I wasn't sure like how much of it I really watched and how much of it like just my memory conjured up. And you wouldn't know like what the title is until years and years later when you could finally track it down.
Yeah, that is a weird thing. I mean, I remember as a kid, like, you're fascinated with something, you want to see something. Mm-hmm. But I remember doing it when I was watching the TV version of It, where I was changing the channel when it get too scary. It's like, why are you either watch it or don't watch it? But it's like, why are you cutting away from what in theory has drawn you to it in the first place? But I did that when just something about you're watching it as a kid, and the emotions get too intense, and you just have to cut away.
Oh, I know. There's some scary Canadian movies out there that were on TV. It's
well, for you, as but, someone who's lived most of your life in Canada, what are the films that scream Canada most intensely, whether they be Canucksploitation or not?
Oh, geez. And I think like Adam McGoing's films like really do capture a kind of Canada-ness that's hard to describe. The way people dress, the way they talk. You know, there's something about them that like is not American. Huh. Like David Cronenberg's films, you know, it's sort of obvious answer, but I don't know. Like, you know what? It's tough. It's like really tough because like a lot of these films don't scream Canada to me.
My Winnipeg by Guy Madden screams Canada.
Oh my God. I hate that film.
Well, and you had to watch it a bunch in film school, correct?
Right. Like, then you have to write an essay on it. And like people are, I don't know. Canadians kind of have a weird relationship, I think, with the idea of Canadian culture and what makes us Canadian. And they're like a little bit obsessive about like celebrating any kind of little thing that's Canadian. So like, you know, you finally make a good one and then they just repeat it ad nauseum until you get sick of it. Or, I mean, the only thing that was like worse in film school is they made us watch, I think it was like almost every single class that I ever took, I had to watch either the whole thing or the Odessa step sequence of Battleship Potemkin.
Which is amazing first few times you see it, but after a while, like, all right, we got it. Eisenstein was a genius, but we don't need to see it in every class.
Right. You get sick of it really fast. I
promise. Or at least watch the whole movie. Like, watch, cause there's more to Battleship Potemkin than just that one scene. Like, everybody talks about that scene, but there's a hell of a lot about it.
I mean, what I think of when I think of Canadian cinema more than any of the fiction films or the documentaries, really, like the NFB, there was such a good history of these short documentaries or a little bit longer documentaries or like films that were not exactly fiction, but kind of staged, like, you know, big part of like my father wanting to come to Canada was watching stuff like Les Voyageurs, showing the Voyageurs in, you know, early days of Canadian history, navigating the waters and things like that. Like, I always loved the nature documentaries. I think like when I think of Canada, I love the openness of the nature, the wilderness. That's something I'm always drawn to. Crossing Canada, like that I'm sort of more romantic about.
Well, I'm romantic about any country that has a thriving exploitation period of any kind. I mean, I feel like the American exploitation period in the 60s and 70s is particularly rich. I mean, whether you're talking about Russ Meyer or Jack Hill or like the best of black exploitation, like in the 60s and 70s, the drive-in phenomenon led to, you know, porn films, cop films, horror films, and there are so many extraordinary gems to be discovered. But I love it when a documentarian comes along and makes a movie that kind of captures that whole era, whether it's the exploitation films made in the Philippines by Roger Corman or the ones being made in Australia. Somebody needs to make a movie like Electric Boogaloo, but make it about the Canadian exploitation movement. Because I feel like there's like dozens, if not hundreds, of films that the real experts and savants on this topic really talk about.
I'm sure that like we're not even scratching the surface. This is like the very tip of the iceberg.
Well, we're talking about the most obvious ones, like the most famous ones. But there's a deep, deep, deep reservoir of obscure films to dig through.
Absolutely. So I think that probably about wraps things up. I was just wondering, are there any craziest moments that you wanted to shout out, or have we listed them all?
Craziest moments. I mean, definitely weird things, like in the pit where Jamie cuts the image out of the erotic photography book and then sits outside the window where after he sent in an envelope that picture to a teacher and he watches she tears it up. There's something just very, very pervy and creepy about this teenage boy sending this you know, this cutout from a book to the librarian whose book ended up, it got cut out of. I don't know. There's the pit, I feel like you could basically psychoanalyze the pit for a year and still be digging through all the little juicy morsels that film has to offer. And so, Porky's is great, raunchy fun. And Shivers is disturbingly erotic in a lot of ways, where it almost kind of catches you off guard by the fact that it is a turn-on in spite of being a horror movie. But because the pit has such an innate identity crisis about what it is trying to accomplish and what movie it is trying to be, it leads to all these interesting contradictions that make it unlike any movie from this discussion that we've come across. So yeah, it blew my mind as a kid, but as an adult, it blows my mind 100 times more so, because now it's just this bizarre so cultural strange. Oddity unlike any I've ever
seen. There are things that just feel like so miscalibrated in some of these films in a kind of way that makes them memorable.
Well, there is something cool about Prom Night that I really love. It's the first scene. There's something about that really bright, intense sunlight outside mm-hmm. with like children playing, with the contrast of being indoors, that just it just reminds me of my own childhood for some reason, and just seeing how demonic and evil children can be when they're playing that game, like kill, kill, kill. Yes. I mean, that's one thing that I guess reminded me within the pit was how he's got this secret, this pit full of like monsters, but a lot of kids do have a secret, like say you break something that's valuable mm-hmm. or you own something that you shouldn't own. Kids do have these crazy dark secrets that adults and their parents are just blissfully totally unaware of. And something about that that makes the pit hit so hard, but also that first scene in Prom Night with the little kids scaring this girl, making her fall out the window. And for me, that might be the scariest scene in the entire movie.
Well, that's true. I mean, there's a lot of like creepy kid stuff in all of these movies. The Brood, of course. Yeah. All right. Yep. Well, I guess that probably wraps things up. I think we covered a lot.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me to rant and rave about sex, violence, and horror and all my favorite subjects in the context of Canadian cinema. I got a lot of creepy
people. They need to know how disreputable Canadian films actually are.
And they should also know that you and I are basically well-intentioned amateurs on this topic, and there are people out there who are full-blown, hardcore, encyclopedic experts on this topic that can lead you to down even stranger paths to more obscure delights than the ones we've discussed.
Absolutely. So where can folks find you on the internet?
People can find me on the Twitter sphere at Colbrax or Wrongreal at Wrongreal. We also have a Facebook page, which is just Wrongreal, and you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or just go to our website, wrongreal.com. And we've probably got, at this point, 10 episodes starring the great Martin Kessler. People really seem to love Martin's appearances, whether it's our Jodorowsky episode or our Stephen King episode or erotic sci-fi. Resident Evil. We've covered a lot of cool topics, and now we've got to figure out the way to get you back for another one.
So, if people want to follow me, I'm at Movie Kessler on Twitter. Of course, the show's Twitter is at FlixWise, and if you want to find more episodes, you just check out FlixWise.com. If you're somebody who rates and reviews iTunes podcasts, go ahead and do it. I dare you.
FlixWise Canada till I die. I will write a review.
Thank you. All right. Till next time, take care. Bye.
To a place.